In Acts chapter 11, well, I guess starting in chapter 10, really, the events are begun that lead to the conversion of Cornelius and his family. And in Acts chapter 11, there's a term used in verse 14 where it's being explained that there's going to be words by which he and his family will be saved. But the term that's used in verse 14 is household. It says, send men to Joppa in verse 13, call for Simon, whose surname is Peter, who will tell you words by which you and all your household will be saved. And that similar term is used in Acts chapter 16 and verse 15, when Lydia is converted. It says, and when she and her household were baptized, she begged us, saying, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. So she persuaded us. Okay, and then in verse 31 of the same chapter, when the Philippian jailer is converted. Verse 31, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, they tell him, and you will be saved and your household. And that term, I think, meant something a little bit different in the first century than it did for us now. There was more a culture of devotion to the head as far as society goes, the head of the household, whoever that was, whether that was Lydia or whether that was the Philippian jailer, whether that was Cornelius. There was the term that you could use to describe it, I think, would be piety. There's this devotion, this trust that says my number one priority is, in as far as earthly relationships go, is to be devoted to my house, be devoted to my household. And I think that the scriptures show us that really that notion, the idea that the family, the household, is massively important, spiritually speaking, is all the way through the scripture. I think it shows us that. In Acts chapter 18, you get it again, in verse 8. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household. And many of the Corinthians hearing believed and were baptized. Okay? Do you think there's a chance that maybe one of Crispus's kids or grandkids was like, well, I don't know about this. I'm still kind of leaning toward Judaism. That's probably kind of likely. But when Crispus believed, the piety of his household said, we follow that. And I think that culture is something that over time throughout history has kind of been lost. You can look at the difference between the way economy was done in the first century and the way economy is done now, and think about where the father is, where he spends the majority of his day. In the first century, I mean, you worked probably in a shop or as a craftsman, something along those lines, and you would work on the bottom floor and your family lived on the top floor. You were home. Then the Industrial Revolution happened and took the father out of the home for 8 hours a day. Now he's disconnected when he comes back and he has a hard time relating to his family, relating to his kids and his wife. And there's a spiritual consequence that comes with all of that. And we just have to remember that we need to be emulating the household that the scriptures talk about. And that's one that I think I'll leave until I can get a bit more of a detailed lesson on this topic. But for this morning, I want to make the point that God's version of the household, the way that he created the family to be, is the way that he expects us to fight our spiritual warfare. That if you want to change the culture around you, if you want to bring more Christianity into the world, then the household is the avenue by which he's given us the tool, the power to do that. The evangelism of the household. So, let's go to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians chapter 6. And you're probably aware of this passage in verse 10, where Paul starts talking about the armor of God. He says, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Then he starts describing the armor of God. Okay, I want to submit to you that 1 Corinthians chapter 6, starting in verse 10, and down through verse 18, roughly, is where most people start and end the lessons that they give on the armor of God. But I don't think that it's independent from the rest of the context of the book. If you think about what Paul has just said before, put on the whole armor of God, he's saying, you're getting ready to go to war. What's he say at the beginning of that very chapter? Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it may be well with you, and you may live long on the earth, and your fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. And then he starts talking about bondservants and masters and the piety, the devotion that is to be had there. And then he says, put on the whole armor of God. I don't think that's mutually exclusive. He's saying the family, this relationship of devotion, is the way that you go to war. And I think that he includes that in the rest of the book, too. The first few chapters are kind of talking about the nature of Christ and what he has done for us. But then in chapter 4, he starts just throwing out applicable things. Walk in unity. You want to change the culture around you? Be unified in the church. In chapter 5, walk in love. Demonstrate love. Walk in light. Walk in wisdom. And that's just the rough outline of the chapter, right? But then he starts talking about marriage and the relationship between the husband and wife relationship and the Christ and church relationship. And then he ends the chapter with, put on the whole armor of God. In a sense, saying this is the way that you're going to fight this battle. This is the way you're going to affect change in the places around you. You can look at 2 Corinthians. Chapter 10. In verse 1, it says, now I, Paul, myself, am pleading with you. Now I, Paul, myself, am pleading with you by the meekness and gentleness of Christ, who in presence am lowly among you, but absent, being absent and bold towards you. But I beg you that when I am present, I may not be bold with that confidence by which I intend to be bold against some who think of us as if we walked according to the flesh. And he explains the difference between walking in the flesh and walking in the Spirit. It says, for though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God for pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. So there, Paul's singing the same tune as Ephesians chapter 6, where he says, find it so I don't misquote it. We do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, the rulers of darkness of this age. And so you could argue that the way that you fight that battle, the way that you fight against the principalities and the powers, the way that you fight against Satan, you take resources from him, is you make your children off limits to Satan. You teach them. You bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. You study as a family. You protect your family. That's your front line, if you will. The household. That's where we fight the spiritual warfare. And if you want to affect change in the culture, if you want to create more Christians, you have children. You raise Christians. And then, ideally, you help them to have the training and the understanding to raise their own family of Christians. And the numbers grow and grow and grow. That's the front line. That's where we fight the spiritual warfare. If you look at Jeremiah chapter 29. And you can start this thought off by thinking about what it's like to live in a culture that is not Christianity focused, that is really anti-God in a lot of ways, and living in a time that is that way. Then you look at Jeremiah chapter 29 and verse 1, it says, "Now these are the words of the letter that Jeremiah the prophet sent from Jerusalem to the remainder of the elders who were carried away captive, to the priests, the prophets, and all the people whom Nebuchadnezzar had carried away captive from Jerusalem to Babylon." So Jeremiah is writing to people who have been people of God, who have been taken and placed in a context, a culture, that is not kind to service to God. And this is what he says for them to do. Verse 5, "Build houses and dwell in them. Plant gardens and eat their fruit. Take wives and beget sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands so that they may bear sons and daughters, that you may be increased there and not diminished." And Jeremiah says, okay, you're stuck in Babylon. What do I do? What's the way that I change the culture around me, build a foundation for service to God in the culture around me? And Jeremiah says, it's the household. You build houses, plant gardens. And in the next lesson I do about this, that planting gardens part I think is really important for raising children and who are trained and admonished to be in service to the Lord, because it gives them responsibility and it gives them a way to contribute to the family, which is important. He says, take wives, beget sons and daughters. So it goes down to your next generation. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters to husbands so that they may bear sons and daughters. And it goes down to the next generation. And Jeremiah says you have to build this generational service to God. That's that frontline foundation against the culture that is anti-God. That's what we have to be able to do as well. I think that that applies. The reason that this is so important, not only for the foundation of the church, the family being the next step down, if you're going to break it down in subcategories, right? Not only for the foundation of the church, not only for the change to affect change in culture around us, but also simply for the spiritual connection between the family, the marriage relationship, right? And then what it's going to be like in the resurrection. I think that there's a connection there. So if you look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, the context of this verse, it sometimes gets taken out of context and misapplied, but talks about in chapter 5, talking about honoring widows who are actually widows, there in verse 3. So the idea being that if there are widows who actually have no one to take care of them, then the church can step in and take care of them. And that's talking about financially, that's talking about places to stay, that like if the widow has nobody else, okay? But if the widow has other people, like a son or a cousin, it's somebody who should be taking care of them, then it's that person's responsibility. That's the point Paul is making here. And in verse 8, he says about that person whose responsibility is, "But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." And I think that it sounds kind of harsh just on the surface, but I think that the point Paul is making is that once you have decided that the household is not your priority, you've left the pattern that God made. You've decided that if I say my household is not worth me providing for it, then I've said the same thing about God's household. I've said the same thing about God's family. And I think that's what it means by you're worse than an unbeliever. Because you've left the pattern. You've left the idea, the instruction that God has given. And in Galatians chapter 6, Galatians chapter 6, verse 9. He's talking about just in general Christian behavior and doing good to all. But he says in verse 9, let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. That's the same Greek word, oikos, household. And I think that that's partly the connection. If I've given up on my oikos, my household, then I've given up on God's household. And then there's Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. Do you see the connection between my household and God's household? We're being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. If we've given up on God's household, we've given up on a dwelling place that we are to be for him. We've given up on the foundation that Jesus, being the cornerstone of, and the apostles and the prophets, we've given up on that foundation. If we give up on the household of God, if we give up on our household. That's why that devotion, that piety is so, so important. And finally, if you go to Revelation chapter 21. You know, there's, sometimes I think there's a misconception about what Jesus says to the Sadducees about the resurrection. You know, they come to him and they say, one woman had seven husbands or something like that. And then in the resurrection, who will she belong to? And Jesus says, well, in the resurrection, they're neither given in marriage nor is there any marrying, right? But I think people take that and say, well, there's no marriage at all in heaven. There's no marriage at all in the resurrection. But there is. You look at Revelation chapter 21. In verse 9. Then one of the seven angels who had seven bowls filled with the seven last plagues came to me and talked with me, saying, come, I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. There is a marriage to be had in the resurrection. It's the marriage between Christ and his people. The Lamb's bride. And look at the description. He carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the great city, holy Jerusalem, spiritual kingdom, right? Descending out of the heaven from God. Having the glory of God, her light was like a most precious stone, like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. And she had a great and high wall with 12 gates and 12 angels at the gates and names written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. And it's a great description and a majestic description. The construction of its wall was of jasper. The city was pure gold like clear glass in verse 18, right? And the application I want to make is that, we need to be trying to be a good household in order to be a family that acts as a pillar and a foundation of the church as a whole, right? That's the application that's generally made. But I think we need to be working to make our households a reflection of the resurrection, that glorious family dynamic where there's God the Father, there's Jesus and his bride, the church, and a whole bunch of children, right? That's the idea, is that we're trying to make our households a reflection, a shadow, if you will, of the real thing. And it goes in layers, right? Our household needs to be a reflection of the church. I think it also needs to be a reflection of heaven and the family of God, the household of God. In Hebrews chapter 13, we did a class on this passage not too long ago, but Hebrews chapter 13, we'll start in verse 12. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore, let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach. Okay? So, we see there that there's the relationship between this passage in Ephesians chapter 5, right? Jesus gave himself for me as a sacrifice, and so I give myself to him in submission and obedience. Same relationship, Christ and the church, husband and wife, right? So we make the connection to the family dynamic. Verse 14, for here we have no continuing city, but we seek the one to come. All of the submission, the obedience, all of the sacrificing that we do in order to make our household a reflection, right? It's because we have hope of actually obtaining that immediate family connection, being in the household of God. And I think that that's really powerful, and that should serve as our motivation to build our homes into things that reflect the church and heaven. That's what I've got for you this morning. It was a bit of a short lesson, but it was written a little bit on the fly. So there's an invitation now. If there's somebody here who is not a member of the household of faith, and you want to enjoy all the spiritual blessings that come with being in the household of God, being a part of God's family, then there's an invitation for you now if you want to obey the gospel. And then also there's an invitation if your household has been neglected by you, or if you've been struggling to build it into a reflection of God's family, then we're here to help you with that as well. So if you have a need, please let it be made known while we stand and sing.